Please pray with me. Oh Lord, we pause in this moment and in this anniversary year to mark the passage of time. Your people, the Hebrews, stack stones to remember that the hand of the Lord is mighty. We too want to remember the past, men and women like Susanna, Charles and John Wesley, Francis Asbury, and others who continue to inspire us. We remember the times when you have guided this institution, and we confess to moments and eras when this institution has failed you. Give us the strength and the wisdom to be living stones that represent your love, your justice, and your peace. Amen. There's a roadside marker in Virginia that indicates the location of Francis Asbury's death. It reads, Bishop Francis Asbury died March 31st, 1816. Asbury, born in England in 1745, came to America in 1771 and labored here until his death. Our guest this morning, John Wigger, is the author of a book published by Oxford University Press in 2009 entitled American Saint, Francis Asbury and the Methodists. This acclaimed book enfleshes that bare-bones historical marker. Francis Asbury in this book becomes a living, breathing man with a good sense of humor, a deeply rooted piety, an organizational genius, and a commitment to sharing the gospel. The book is not hagiographic. John Wigger has captured this university's namesake in all of his idiosyncrasies. For example, despite being a delightful conversationalist, Asbury was notorious for giving disjointed sermons that were almost impossible to follow. All that to say, John Wigger's book describes Asbury as a saint with issues, someone we can at least a little bit relate to. John earned his PhD from the undefeated University of Notre Dame, and is now a professor and chair of the history department at the University of Missouri. Please welcome historian John Wigger to campus.
Well, thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. David and I are both products of the same graduate program and a lot of the same graduate advisors. And in fact, David just sort of summarized everything I was going to say today, so you've already had it in microcosm. But it is a pleasure to be here and talk to you about Frank Asbury, who your university is named after. I suspect that before you came here, and perhaps even now, Asbury is not a name that's abundantly familiar to you. And yet, in a lot of ways, I think he is one of the key religious leaders, one of the key cultural shapers in American history. Certainly the church, the religious movement that he was involved in creating, Methodism and all of its branches, the Holiness Movement, Pentecostalism, are not only key figure or key religious movements in America, but around the world today. When Asbury came to America, Methodism was just a loose connection of a few hundred people. By the Civil War, a third of all churchgoers were Methodists. By the end of the 19th century, there were more Methodist churches than post offices in America. Again, the Holiness Movement, Pentecostalism, that are huge in Africa, Asia, South America today, are largely outgrowths of the Methodist movement. And a lot of this flows back to Francis Asbury. It's connected to things he did, not just Asbury, but again, he is one of the sort of people that linked this all together, that made this all possible. So who is Asbury? Well, he's an unlikely leader, and I think that's one of the reasons why he probably is not as well known as other figures in American history, American religious history. So one way to look at this is when I was beginning this project, the biography, just for fun, I sent a questionnaire out to a web discussion group of historians who do American religion. And I asked them to list the 10 key leaders in American religious history. And I got back the usual suspects. When I tallied them all up, Jonathan Edwards got more votes than anybody else. George Whitfield, Charles Finney, Billy Graham, Amy Semple McPherson, Phoebe Palmer was in there as well. Frank got two votes, and one of those was from a friend of mine who knew what I was doing. He was down with Elvis and the Beatles. And these are people that do this for a living. These are historians of American religion. So why is Asbury such an unusual and unlikely leader? Well, I think part of it is the way that we tend to look at leadership in religious movements, and I think this goes beyond religious movements as well. So when we think of religious leaders, I think we tend to lump them into three categories. We either think of them as intellectuals, people like Jonathan Edwards, Reinhold Niebuhr, the kind of people who publish influential books, whose intellectual arguments we think we rely on to shape our lives, maybe not our lives, but the religious movements that we're involved in. So intellectuals. The second category are great communicators, people that are simply good in public settings, who are good at communicating with large audiences in whatever format. So you think of people like George Whitfield or Billy Graham, these kinds of people, Charles Finney, the great communicators, if you will, of American religion. And then those are both positive categories, right? You want to be an intellectual or a great communicator. Those aren't things that you mind people saying about you. The third category are autocrats. In other words, people that are able to impose their will on others, who are able to get people to do what they want, maybe if it's not even in their best interest. The problem with Asbury is he's none of these three. He was not an intellectual. He had what you would think of as the equivalent of a sixth grade education. His parents were working class people in England. He never wrote a book. He kept a journal for his 45 years in America, wrote thousands, tens of thousands of letters, but he simply was not an intellectual. He was also not a great communicator. As David said, he was actually a terrible preacher. He was hard to follow. People came to hear him with great expectation, especially toward the end of his life, when he was this renowned saintly figure in American Methodism. And they always went away puzzled, because it just didn't quite live up to their expectations. One of my favorite stories, and this is maybe apocryphal, but at one point in his career, Asbury was traveling through New Jersey with one of the other Methodist preachers, Jesse Lee. And they were going to a church where Asbury was supposed to preach, and they were late, and Asbury was not feeling well. So right before they got there, he asked Lee if he would preach in his place, and then Asbury would give an exhortation afterwards. This was the common practice if you had more than two preachers present. One would preach, and then one would just say a few words afterwards, what they called an exhortation. But they decided to switch and have Lee give the sermon. But they didn't tell the people because they got there right as the sermon was starting, the service was starting. And so they did their thing. Lee preached and Asbury exhorted. And afterwards, a lot of the people said that they loved the bishop's sermon, but they didn't care very much for that old man that talked after him. He was not comfortable in public settings. Even after he'd been the bishop of the church for 30 years, he rarely spoke at annual or general conferences. There was something intimidating about it to him that he could never get over, that never went away. So, not a great communicator, not an intellectual, also not an autocrat. I hope I can convince you today, he wasn't the sort of leader that could just push people around. And if you think about it, in the voluntary structure of American religion, especially after the American Revolution, that really wasn't a model that was going to work anyways. So I think part of the problem with Asbury is that he doesn't fit into categories that we're used to talking about, that we're used to thinking about. And so it's hard to think of him in a way that does fit, if you will. Well, if he isn't any of those things, what was he? And I'm going to offer you four keys, I think, that defined Asbury's leadership in American Methodism. I think this is a model for leadership in a lot of American religious movements. In fact, I think it's a model of leadership beyond just religious movements as well, if you kind of work these ideas and extend them out a little bit. So the first of these keys is Asbury's piety. When I was writing about this, I picked the word piety. It's kind of an old-fashioned word. It's not a word that we use very much anymore. I didn't want to say spirituality because that means different things to different people. So I settled on piety. And what I mean by that is just his basic core spiritual values, his core spiritual self. In fact, Asbury was someone who throughout his life got up at 4 or 5 in the morning to pray for an hour in the stillness before dawn. He led an incredibly hectic and busy life, and yet throughout his career, again, that was something that never changed. He lived a life of voluntary poverty. He gave away almost all the money that people pushed into his hands. He never owned a home. He never got married. In fact, he never owned much more than he could carry on horseback, even when he was a legendary and renowned figure. He had this practice that, and again, he spent his entire life traveling, as I'll describe for you in a moment here. But he had this practice of setting out on a journey without enough money to get him to his destination, because he wanted to have to rely on people along the way. He wanted them to see that he didn't have anything extra. In fact, he didn't even have enough to get from Philadelphia to New York, if that's where he was going. It was this sort of, it was a part of his core spiritual self, if you will, his core spiritual values. And people saw that, and it wasn't something that he did simply because he knew people would see it, although he knew that as well. But people saw it, and they saw a degree of authenticity. It's the same sort of thing. I think a lot of people have had that reaction about the current pope, especially as they've watched him in America. Even if they don't like the pope, even if they don't like Catholicism, there's something that they see there that they're drawn to. And that was certainly true of Asbury. And I think it's key to understanding his leadership, to understanding his influence. If there had been anything false about that, if there had been anything sort of half-hearted, people would have noticed, people would have seen that, and they didn't. So his piety, that's sort of the first pillar, if you will, that his leadership was built on. The second was his ability to connect with people. As I've said, he was really a terrible public speaker, but in small groups, one-on-one, he had an ability to connect with people that is difficult to explain. It was difficult for people at the time to explain, but was absolutely magnetic. People would spend one evening with him, and from then on, they would be devoted to him for the rest of their lives. Asbury and his ministry, so he's here in America for 45 years, during most of which time he's the bishop of the church. He simply spent that 45 years traveling. He never stayed in any one place for more than a few days. He would spend a few weeks in Charleston, South Carolina in the winter. But in general, he never stayed in any one place for more than a few days. He spent his entire career itinerating, traveling around the United States as it expanded. He would generally start in Charleston in the winter. I mean, he spent his winters in the South. He wasn't a dummy in that regard. He would go up the East Coast to New England, maybe as far as Canada. He would go west to the frontier. He would go south down the middle part of the frontier, or however far out the state stretched at that point. And it was a yearly circuit that he made, and he never made exactly the same circuit twice. So each year was a slightly different circuit so that he could meet new people. And wherever he went, he talked to people. He talked to them as he rode along on the road. He stayed in people's homes at night. He talked to whoever was putting him up. He talked relentlessly, constantly, to people around the country, Methodists and non-Methodists alike, poor people, rich people, more poor people than rich people, common people. Asbury would talk to anyone. And given the communication technology of the time, that along with writing the tens of thousands of letters that he wrote and received over the course of his career, this allowed him to feel the pulse of the nation, to feel the pulse of his people. He understood American Methodism in a way that no one else did. And again, he had this ability to connect with people that was deep, that was sincere, that was genuine. The closer people got to him, the more they liked him. How many leaders can you say that about? And it was the kind of relationship where people would see him at unguarded moments. He lived as a house guest in other people's homes for 45 years. I mean, think about that. You've traveled, you've lived out of a suitcase for a few weeks at a time, right? How hard is that? How hard is it to stay in someone else's home, not a relative, not someone you know very well, to stay in their home for a few days? How would that be to do that for your entire life? And yet it was the kind of thing that Asbury thrived off of. He wanted to know his people. He wanted to be connected to them. And again, the more time he spent in their homes, the more they liked him. He had a sly sense of humor, which was unusual for 19th century preachers. The assumption was that laughing and joking weren't part of the serious spiritual life, the way that most 19th century Americans looked at it. And yet there are countless stories of Asbury's humor, of his telling jokes. And he often chided himself for this. In his journal, he would often sit down at the end of the day and say that he shouldn't have done this, that he shouldn't have stayed up so late, that he shouldn't have told the stories he told. He thought it was a drain on his piety. But in fact, I think it was really one of the things that allowed him to connect to people. Maybe I have time for one story about his humor, because I've talked about it, and if I don't tell you a story, it's kind of hard to understand the way he could use humor to diffuse situations. So here's the story. Right before the American Revolution, John Wesley sent another English preacher to America, a guy named Thomas Rankin, because Wesley was concerned that Methodists weren't holding to strict Methodist discipline. And he knew that Rankin, who was a dour and a very straight-laced person, would enforce that discipline in American Methodism. So Rankin came. He was the lead preacher in America. And during the summer of 1776, he made a tour through the South. Now, at that point, not many Methodist preachers had actually gone to the American South and seen what was going on there. Asbury had, as a matter of fact. It was an enormous revival that was taking place in the South. But along with that, American Methodists in the South had their own style, and it was a very emotional, enthusiastic style. People would shout during sermons. They would fall to the floor. Methodists at that time were known as shouting Methodists in the South. Sometimes the services would get so noisy with people crying out and shouting and praying spontaneously that you couldn't even hear the preacher. And in fact, this happened to Rankin on several occasions. He was in the South. He was trying to preach. People were shouting and screaming and falling to the floor. And Rankin was horrified, because this isn't the way they did it in England. And it certainly wasn't what he wanted to see either. So a little later, a few months later, he got all of the American preachers together in a conference. And most of them were young Americans, and most of them were Southerners, because that's where all the growth was. That's where the revivals were taking place. And he had these young preachers in a room, and he started to lay into them about this enthusiasm, which he described as wildfire. And he told them that they absolutely had to put a stop to it. And what was even worse, he had seen some of them engaging in this as well. And as Rankin's sort of winding himself up, Asbury is sitting there, and he's realizing that these young preachers aren't buying it. To them, this is authentic religion. To them, this is the heart of the revival that they're seeing in the South. And they don't like what they're hearing from Rankin. And so Asbury decides he's got to do something to diffuse this situation, to sort of break in. And so as Rankin's speaking, Asbury stands up, and he points across the room, and he says, I thought, and Rankin says, "Pray, Mr. Asbury, what did you thought?" And Frank says, "I thought I saw a mouse." Okay, it's not that funny, right? But everyone just erupted in laughter. Um, it it must have been timed perfectly. He understood his audience. He knew these guys. And at that moment, Rankin realized that these guys were laughing at him, that they understood what Asbury meant. And actually, Rankin never forgave Asbury for that moment. But it did diffuse the situation. It changed the direction of the discussion. So his piety, his ability to connect with people. The third thing was his feel for popular culture. Asbury had and I think he shares this with Wesley. Both Wesley and Asbury understood how to make religion appealing in their time and place, how to engage popular culture. Charles Wesley wrote these hymns to popular tunes. It was songs that people enjoyed singing. It was contemporary at the time. And Asbury does the same thing in America. When he sees something that works, that connects, so to speak, he uses that. So the enthusiasm of Southern worship, it actually wasn't Asbury's style. He was never one of the shouters at these meetings, but he understood that there was something authentic about it, and so that it's something that he made use of. Camp meetings are another thing. When camp meetings come along in the early 1800s, Asbury only has to go to one or two, and he realizes that these are something new. This is a new way to connect to people. And what was new about them was, quite by accident, they discovered that if you moved the service outside of the church to an open outdoor place, lots of people would come who wouldn't come to an enclosed building to attend a service. And these things just erupted. Within a decade, they were doing 500 or 600 of them across the country. They attracted sometimes thousands of people. The point here is Asbury only had to see one or two of these before he understood that this was a way to connect to culture, that this was a way to engage people in a way that they just hadn't been before. So piety, his ability to connect, his ability to perceive and connect to popular culture. The last was his ability to organize. And again, this gets back to his relentlessly itinerating and traveling around the country given the communication technology, really being able to understand his church and his movement. It was more work than genius. But one of the things he had to do each year was assign the preachers to their circuits. And by the end of his career, he had 400 or 500 preachers to assign to their circuits each year. And if you didn't know those guys, if you didn't know those circuits, if you didn't know those settings, how could you have done that right? How could you have gotten the right people in the right place? And this is exactly why he did so much of this traveling. And not only did he travel, but when he would get to a place, he would consult with the local leaders, if you will. So the leaders of each circuit were called presiding elders. Asbury would ride into town, and I actually found this notebook at Drew University in their archives. It didn't have any name on it. It wasn't clear whose it was, but after I looked at it for a little bit, I became convinced that it was Asbury's. Part of it is in his hand, but a lot of it is in a number of different other hands, a number of other people's handwriting. And what it is it's these, for each of the conferences he would go to, it's a short one or two sentence description of all the new preachers. And it's one or two sentences because he had to carry this on horseback. He couldn't carry a lot of stuff with him. And obviously what he did is he would ride into town to one of these conferences, and he would hand this notebook to the presiding elder, the preacher who was in charge of the circuit, and he would say, write me a brief description of all the new preachers. And they would do that. And he would use this information to figure out where to assign people. And they're candid and they're unguarded, and some of them are absolutely hilarious. They'll describe preachers as, basically untalented or untrustworthy or people you couldn't trust around young women, or these sorts of things. Some of them got glowing reports, of course, but it was this ability to organize based on a deep connectedness to his church, to his movement. And again, I think you can take these kinds of things. Asbury's setting is never going to return again. Obviously, you don't have to travel around the country on horseback to gain information. But I think if you look at the principles of what he did, I think this defines leadership in a lot of successful, large-scale religious movements in American history. So in other words, if you think about the biggest religious movements in our history, Catholicism, the Baptist, the Methodist, Pentecostalism, how many leaders of these movements can you think of? Just off the top of your head. Well, actually, not all that many. Not all that many names come to mind. And if they do, they're probably like those first categories that I described for you, great communicators, intellectuals. But the people that really sustain these movements, that put them together, that made them work, how many names can you pick out? Well, really not all that many. And I think that is not because they weren't there. I think it's just because we haven't seen them. We haven't appreciated that these people are there, that they played these roles. And I think it's skewed our perception, if you will, of what it means to be a leader, what it means to be a servant, what it means to be the kind of person who puts these kinds of movements together. Well, thank you. I think that's all I have time for today. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and let me close in prayer if I could. Lord God, I thank you for this opportunity to be in this setting, to join with this group, to talk about Frank Asbury, to talk about the church that he helped to found, the church that has been so much a part of our lives, our culture. I pray that you would help us to learn from Asbury's life, that you would help us to take the lessons that we can incorporate from what you did through this wonderful servant of yours, and incorporate them into our lives. Amen. Thank you.